The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory, straight of the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Actually, I heard him, he subconsciously mocks that lineage. But he's
so that's happening. Okay.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've got a lot coming up on the show today, and we're going to start with Amy Davidson Sorkin, who's a political columnist for The New Yorker. I wanted to talk with Amy about Alabama's election of Doug Jones and what it means in Washington for the Democrats, the Republican Party, and President Trump.
Do you think the election, no matter how close, was a turning point in some way for the President of the United States? Taken into context with the results in New Jersey and Virginia and elsewhere.
You mean that he can't win all of the time?
Yeah.
It depends on how he plays it. I don't know if you saw his morning after the election tweet where he basically said—
I predicted it.
The message of this was that Trump was right all along. And that if only he'd been allowed to play it the way he wanted to, there'd be a Republican in the Senate right now. Is it a turning point in our assessment of Trump's moral capacities? I think there's a lot of things that we knew about him that were very much on display in this. But what we didn't
know— For example?
Well, this is a man who called during the presidential campaign as part of appealing to votes for a complete and total ban on Muslims entering the country. Is it shocking that he would endorse a man who doesn't believe Muslims should enter Congress? There's a lot going on there. But what I think we didn't know about Trump before the Alabama race that we know now is how docile he can make Republican leaders, and how much the mechanisms of the party are indeed in his hands.
The Washington Post originally came out with a story, a very convincing story, with real deep reporting and evidence and interviewing, laying out the case that Roy Moore, a judge, a candidate for the U.S. Senate, and at that time the overwhelming favorite, was given to acts of really repugnant moral behavior. And nevertheless, through right up until the election day, you would hear all kinds of interviews of supporters of Roy Moore who were able to, in their minds, justify continuing their support. One of the ways that was most common was, well, if I vote against Roy Moore, it's open season for abortion, and countless thousands of children will be killed. That was the moral calculus for many people. What did you make of the moral calculus of the Moore voters, and they're willing to tolerate or willingly suspend disbelief about his past?
You know, it's the overused term, fake news. That they didn't believe it, or they believed it or they sort of believed it, or they thought maybe there was some version of it, and what they told themselves about the Democrat. It's part of a larger and troubling question that doesn't only have to do with Alabama. But I also want to go back to one thing you said about the rationalization having to do with reproductive rights. You know, it matters that not only did a Democrat win in Alabama, but a Democrat who did not walk away from his position in favor of reproductive rights, who did not sort of back down on that to the extent that some people in Alabama were practically begging him to do. They're like, just stop about that and you'll have no trouble.
Now, did this particular election shift our understanding of what kind of behavior voters will and will not tolerate in their candidates and in their elected officials?
I mean, you know, in American history, there have been some real...
Anybody compare to Roy Moore?
Who we know about? I mean, you know, we've had times in our history when people were physically assaulting each other on the floor of the Senate. But what I think was striking, and again, is how much somebody who's a wildly eccentric candidate can nonetheless count on the support of his party for quite a while.
Do you think that in politics that Democrats have seized the moral high ground in any way, cumulatively?
I don't think that it belongs to a party at this point. I think that there are individual politicians who've, you know, been out there and taking stands, but I think that it's really too much in flux for there to be real self-congratulation at a certain point. Obviously, you can always say they were worse, but if there's a political party whose only standard is we didn't do that, then you're not very far along.
Did you think the Democratic Party did the right thing of essentially pushing out Al Franken?
It's an interesting question in that what you ideally want is for the voters to have the chance to push people out.
As the employers.
They didn't. Yeah, as the employers. But if you know that you don't have your party's support and you don't have the support of your colleagues, and then you do think as a politician of, you know, if these are actually causes that I believe in and it's not about me, then you think about who could be appointed to your job. But I'm sorry that in his speech he was so deflecting. Again, it was this, why me and not Trump? And I don't think that that's the right approach at this moment.
Why?
Well, because it gets you into a couple of not great places, one of which is, you know, there's always somebody worse. There's always going to be something worse, and it ups what you're going to tolerate. And the other is that I think one of the big problems we have now, and we've talked about this before, is how disreputable politics seems as a profession, you know, and if it's like, this is how it works, this is how Congress is, this is what you put up with if you want this guy who's going to vote for that, that's a terrible place for us to be in as a democracy. And I would also say about Franken, though, and the Democratic Party, that I think one role he played, fairly or unfairly, was being the party has a lot of unfinished business with Bill Clinton, you know, and in some ways, Al Franken was a proxy for that.
That, yeah. Al Franken was somehow sacrificed to the overlooking of the sins of Bill Clinton in the past.
I think there was a feeling that really too much had been overlooked in that, and that it hurt the party, it had hurt its standing, it had hurt Hillary Clinton's chances in 2016. And I think that there was an unpaid debt there, and there wasn't a lot to draw on. You know, thinking back also to the Clinton period, you know, when Clinton, you know, who was impeached and went through a Senate trial and was acquitted, When his trial was taking place, one of his defenders was Dale Bumpers, who was the senator from Arkansas, one of them from Bill Clinton's home state. And he gave a speech that was very memorable at the time, in which he basically said at one point, you know, when somebody tells you it's not about sex, it's about sex. And his point then was everybody who was saying, oh, it's not about Bill Clinton's affair. It's about lying. It's about perjury. It's about obstruction of justice. That they weren't telling the truth. That was just about sex. I think that what we have now is a really different understanding of that phrase and a different understanding of these dynamics. Now when, for example, the Harvey Weinstein story, when people say now it's not about sex, what they often mean is that the sex itself is not about sex. It's about violence. It's about power. It's about misuse of power. And I think that the complexities of that have really changed over the years, even the phrases that we use and what we tolerate.
What do you think is really going to lead to real substantive change, whether it's in the realm of politics or any other realm?
Looking at politics specifically, and I always think this is true, it's going to be the voting booth. It's got to be. That's where the costs have to be levied.
Meaning more women in power.
There needs to be more women who are elected. There needs to be a political cost to each party for all of that. It's, you know, if there's a, if you think of Congress as a job market or any kind of a market, things have to have a real price. Otherwise, it gets all out of whack. And, you know, some of the things we're hearing about in Congress seem to have to do with these unspoken economies of power and access. And
for example,
there's been a lot of reporting about you know, you have a place where there are a lot of young people who aren't paid very much, who are far from home making connections. You also have lobbyists. You have money. You have a lot of what goes on in Congress is off the books. And it gets tricky, and that might be true in any closed system like that. And to make it less closed, to make it, you know, more transparent, to help people know what they're voting for, and, or, you know, also to have parents look at all of this and want their children to go into politics. Because if it keeps seeming so seedy, who are the congressmen in 20 years going to be? Who is that? Who's drawn to that profession? Is that what you would aspire to as a career? And if not, who's going to be running the country?
Amy Davidson Sorkin, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Amy Davidson Sorkin is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with the novelist Louise Erdrich. But right now, we've got a few words from Jim Gaffigan, whom we find enjoying a night at the symphony.
Don't clap too soon. Wait till they're done. Don't clap too soon. Wait till they're done. I'm a grown man. And I don't know when to clap. Great night. Glad we're doing this. And we get to do it four more times this year. Two tickets to five concerts plus parking. Don't think about it. Don't think about what you could have spent that money on. You know, like one of those three-wheeled motorcycles. Why'd that pop in my head? I don't want one of those. He was zoned out. She noticed. Now she's pissed. I'll hold her hand. Smile. You think for what these tickets cost, the seats would at least be comfortable. Those box seats are probably pretty plush. I guess if you're about to be assassinated, you deserve to be comfortable. That guy looks like he could be an assassin. He's got the assassin's hair. Why do I think an assassin has a certain hair type? That's probably politically incorrect on some level. Just listen to the music. Listen to the music. It's kind of relaxing. Is it relaxing or boring? It is relaxing. Except for the conductor flapping around like that. I know that technically orchestras need a conductor, but do they really? Like, if all the musicians are really good at playing their instruments and they all have music in front of them, couldn't they just play it? I bet it annoys them when he's all, play soft, play soft. Look at my stick getting very low. Now play loud. Look at my stick way up here. You know, if I were in the orchestra, I'd probably roll my eyes, you know, subtly, you know, where the audience, they'd be like, oh my gosh, that guy, he gets it. The good-looking guy. Oh, are they done? Do we clap now? They're not done. I mean, I knew they weren't done. That violin section seems to be where you find the more attractive women. But are they just orchestra attractive? If I were involved with one of the violinists, would I have to learn a lot of stuff about violin? Like if she asked, how'd I play tonight? Would I have to be specific? Or could I just go, great! Or maybe, you should totally be first chair, babe. I know, it's so political. Or maybe, Jesus, Deborah, you're first chair. Why are you still so insecure? All you can think about is some other orchestra, the one you're not in. No, I'm not saying you're not good enough to play with them. Look, I think you're an amazing violinist. Oh, right. Okay. I know nothing about violin because when we first started dating, I just used to say you played great. Well, you know what? That was 8 goddamn years ago, Deborah. I clap now, right? No one's... All right, I'm not going to clap. I'm going to wait for other people to clap. You know, I swear with 1 month of practice, I could play the big drum as well as that guy. It says in the program that is called the timpani. Huh. That's the wrong name. Timpani, that sounds like something like someone on the Upper East Side would name their daughter. Have you met our timpani? Anyway, I could do the timpani solo. Are there timpani solos? I guess 2001 A Space Odyssey sort of had one. Wait, that's horns. I feel like at lunch, everyone ignores the harpist. If she lived in a walk-up, that would be brutal. Like the cello person must be like, oh, at least I don't have a harp. I'm talking about the big cello. You know, like there's different sizes. You know what? My wife is right. Classical music is really opening up my mind. Oh, they're done. Okay, everyone act like they enjoyed it. Thank God it's over. Oh, God. There's more.
Thoughts while attending the first symphony in the series my wife wanted to buy. If you're thinking about buying tickets to the orchestra for Christmas this year, think carefully. That's a piece by Kirk J. Rudell, performed for us by the comedian Jim Gaffigan. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Contemporary fiction in recent years has taken something of an apocalyptic turn. Books that would have been categorized once as science fiction are being recognized as part of the mainstream of literature right now. And that trend has affected even a writer like Louise Erdrich, whose books, although they're certainly diverse, have predominantly been historical or contemporary. Erdrich's new book, just out this fall, is called The Future Home of the Living God. It follows the lives of a group of Ojibwe Indians who are living in rural Minnesota. Louise, you've said that storytelling for you is a kind of addiction almost. When did that addiction begin?
It really began when my other addictions failed, you know. And I started understanding that I could have addictions that didn't give me really a hangover or, you know, were actually addictions that helped me in life. And the only problem was I was still smoking when I started writing. And so I believed for a long time that I couldn't write without a cigarette. And it was hard to break that one.
So you're not kidding around in a way, that there's some relationship between writing, storytelling, and less valuable kinds of addiction?
Oh, I'm not kidding at all. You know, it took hold in my 20s. I was searching for it. You know, I wanted something that would be powerful enough to keep me interested. I must have a short attention span because I was writing poetry and had to tie myself into my chair to finish my first piece of narrative. I had scarves. I had beautiful romantic scarves. And I didn't just use a rope.
Well, when you started to write, I wonder, some writers rebel against the idea of being part of an identity literature, say Jewish American literature or African American literature. They want to be just part of American literature or just themselves. Did you have any sense that you wanted to be part of Native American literature as distinct from anything else?
No, I didn't. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about that at all, what it might mean. The only thing that crushed me about this was that I wanted to be invisible. I was extremely shy, and I still go through that sometimes. I wanted to just have the books. But as a Native American person, you can't do that. You know, you have to tell people who you are.
You have to represent beyond the book.
Well, you have to establish your tribal identity because there's so many people who write books that are ostensibly Native, but they're not Native American writers. And so you really have to tell where you're enrolled or where your family is, or, you know, you don't have to be enrolled. You could be a descendant, but you have to come from a community and a family and a background that's Native American. It's tribal.
So how did that play out? I remember very distinctly just a couple of years out of college reading your first novel, Love Medicine, a wonderful book, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1984. I think you were probably just around 30 at that time.
I had my baby, Persia. She'd just been born, and I was pregnant again, and that book came out. And then the next year, when I had my second baby, The Bee Queen came out. It was insane. I don't know how that happened.
That's a lot of fertility all
at once. I don't know how that happened. Yeah, and I think, seeing as women are just coming out with everything, I just want to say that what happened was really impossible.
How do you mean?
I mean that I look back and I think I must have been really losing my mind most of the time, because you can't do that. And then it took 5 more years for me to write a book, and that was more doable. That would make a little more sense.
This book is really a departure in some sense. They're native characters grappling mm-hmm. with their culture and their families and their ups and downs of life, as many of your characters,
right.
they always have. But the story takes place in some indeterminate time in the future, in the midst of a ecological crisis and a political crisis, and there are food shortages and power outages, and the government is rounding up and detaining, of all things, pregnant women. And so, given the apocalyptic mood of our current politics, or at least some of us feel that way, the book feels timely in a terrible way. You started working on this, though, long before, like 16 years ago. How did this
long
book come
before.
To be?
So I started writing it long before, and the only nod to current events in it is Mother. Now, Mother is basically, she's a kind of scary, pseudo-motherly entrapment figure who seems immune to shut down computers and can just come on at any time, any screen at any time, right? Mother. She's Karen Pence. And my daughter and I have been following Karen Pence and Pence too, because, you know, that's the next lineup. We're like one chocolate cake clogged artery away from from Pence, or maybe it'll be the double scoop of ice cream and then conk, you know? So there we are.
I have to ask this, and maybe you'll reject the premise totally out of hand, but is it possible in terms of the way influence does or does not work that there are echoes of The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's great dystopian novel, in this book?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I hope it can be read in some ways as an homage because, you know, I loved that book. When I started the book and I wrote the book, it wasn't the cultural touchstone that it is now. And also Children of Men. This owes a lot to Children of Men, that P.D. James novel.
Sure.
Yeah. And to Ursula Le Guin and Left Hand of Darkness, all kinds of books, you know. Those were really the books I read as a teenager that got me very excited about literature. And
I think in the acknowledgments or the author's note, you mm-hmm. referred to it as having to be excavated from some old computer. What happened?
Well, I abandoned it because I just didn't think it was going to go anywhere. It was in one of those, I love those Jetson-looking computers. Do you remember the iMacs with the sort of round colored plastic backs?
Well, those were beautiful.
I loved them. And so I didn't want to leave it behind.
So you left a novel in it.
For a long time. And then the iCube came out. You remember the iCube?
I do.
The Thunderbird of computers. It's a really nice computer. So then transferred it into the Cube. And then, you know, I thought, damn, it'll be safe in the Cube. But it wasn't. And so...
Whoa. You don't even think to print it out or put it on a disk or something? It's just sitting in a Cube?
A floppy disk? It was on floppy disks. It was on... I had floppy disks.
Okay, so you were all backed up. I'm just making sure.
I was all backed up.
Now, Louise, the threats to the bodies of Native American women are just not a matter of dystopian fiction. As I understand it, American Indians are 2.5 times more likely to experience sexual assault crimes compared to other races, according to the DOJ, the Department of Justice.
Exactly.
Was that very much on your mind as you wrote this book?
It was more in my mind as I wrote The Roundhouse, but there is inevitably echoes in this book. Most of those crimes are committed by non-natives, knowing that on reservation land, it's very hard to get the attention of the authorities because you have to go to federal authorities for this crime. You have to go to the FBI, and everyone's backed up. The jurisdictional issues are so arcane. So
So tribal courts don't have access to cases like that?
Tribal courts handle a lot, and that's what we're working toward. We want to be able to handle crimes that occur on reservation land, crimes of all sorts. Little by little, tribal court justice and autonomy has been eroded.
What are the odds of that reform ever coming?
Well, at this point in history, we don't even...
Before he was president, Donald Trump clashed repeatedly with Native Americans. One of the running fights was about casinos, and he saw those casinos on reservations as a threat to his own businesses, and he sued the government over them. He argued that he was being discriminated against. At one point, he said, if I remember right, I think I might have more Indian blood in me than a lot of those so-called Indians that are trying to open up the reservations. He said that.
Excuse
the president of the United States.
Just like, oh, my God.
Well, there it is.
Yes, I know. It is there. And we're actually trying to, I mean, I am anyway, trying to keep somewhat of a low profile. I don't want Donald's attention. We don't want Donald's attention, you know? It's all bad attention.
Well, but it's inescapable, isn't it?
I hope he doesn't turn his attention on Native Americans.
Louise Erdrich, the author of Love Medicine and many other books, novels, poetry, and essays. And her new novel is called Future Home of the Living God. In The New Yorker, we just published a short story that did something very unusual for a work of fiction. It's called Cat Person, and not long after it was posted, it went, forgive the cliche, absolutely viral. It quickly became our most read piece of fiction online ever, and it spawned half a dozen think pieces in other publications.
Before he got out of the car, he said darkly, like a warning, just so you know, I have cats. I know, she said. We texted about them, remember?
Cat Person is a story about a date, and it looks at desire, power, and consent in a way that hit a nerve for a lot of readers. Here's the author, Kristen Rupenyan, reading from Cat Person.
Well, this is my house, he said flatly, pushing the door open. The room they were in was dimly lit and full of objects, all of which, as her eyes adjusted, resolved into familiarity. He had two large, full bookcases, a shelf of vinyl records, a collection of board games, and a lot of art, or at least posters that had been hung in frames instead of being tacked or taped to the wall. I like it, she said truthfully, and as she did, she identified the emotion she was feeling as relief. It occurred to her that she'd never gone to someone's house to have sex before. Because she'd dated only guys her age, there had always been some element of sneaking around to avoid roommates. It was new and a little frightening to be so completely on someone else's turf, and the fact that Robert's house gave evidence of his having interests that she shared, if only in their broadest categories, art, games, books, music, struck her as a reassuring endorsement of her choice. As she thought this, she saw that Robert was watching her closely, observing the impression the room had made. And, as though fear weren't quite ready to release its hold on her, she had the brief, wild idea that maybe this was not a room at all, but a trap, meant to lure her into the false belief that Robert was a normal person, a person like her, when in fact all the other rooms in the house were empty or full of horrors, corpses or kidnap victims or chains. But then he was kissing her, throwing her bag and their coats on the couch and ushering her into the bedroom, groping her and pawing at her chest with the avid clumsiness of that first kiss. The bedroom wasn't empty, though it was emptier than the living room. He didn't have a bed frame, just a mattress and a box spring on the floor. There was a bottle of whiskey on his dresser, and he took a swig from it, then handed it to her and kneeled down and opened his laptop, an action that confused her until she understood that he was putting on music. Margot sat on the bed while Robert took off his shirt and unbuckled his pants, pulling them down to his ankles before realizing that he was still wearing his shoes and bending over to untie them. Looking at him like that, so awkwardly bent, his belly thick and soft and covered with hair, Margot recoiled. But the thought of what it would take to stop what she had set in motion was overwhelming. It would require an amount of tact and gentleness that she felt was impossible to summon. It wasn't that she was scared he would try to force her to do something against her will, but that insisting that they stop now, after everything she'd done to push this forward, would make her seem spoiled and capricious, as if she'd ordered something at a restaurant and then, once the food arrived, had changed her mind and sent it back.
That's Kristen Rupenian reading from her story, Cat Person. You can hear her read the whole story in the Writer's Voice podcast at newyorker.com/podcasts. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Given the events of this year, we could all be forgiven if we haven't been paying as much attention to what's going on overseas as we should. But if you're following the world news carefully, you already know that what's going on in Venezuela is just this side of apocalyptic. For Venezuelans, of course, most of all, but it may well have repercussions here in the United States. While oil prices were high, Venezuela's socialist economy under Hugo Chavez seemed to be booming. But Chavez died in 2013 just as oil prices were falling. It was left to his successor, Nicolas Maduro, to deal with the fallout. Now, food shortages are common, medical care and utilities are precarious, crime and violence are rampant, the entire country's a mess. Donald Trump even suggested there might be U.S. military action to bring Venezuela under control. And while he probably didn't mean it, that kind of threat might help drive Venezuela toward alliances with Russia and China. The New Yorker's John Lee Anderson has reported from Latin America for decades, and he recently was granted a very rare interview with Nicolas Maduro. John Lee spoke about it with Dorothy Wickenden, who's the executive editor of The New Yorker.
He doesn't often give interviews, and he obviously had he wanted to spin you as an American. So tell us how that conversation went.
So I know Maduro. I've known him for nearly a decade, and I knew Chavez from the beginning of his presidency in 1999. I'm a known person to them, and I've both written for The New Yorker pieces that they liked and that they didn't like. In the course of time, I think they've come to see me as someone who's balanced. I think that what triggered the decision to give me an interview was Trump's threat of military action against Maduro and his regime in early August of this year.
We have many options for Venezuela. This is our neighbor. This is, we're all over the world. And we have troops all over the world in places that are very, very far away. Venezuela is not very far away, and the people are suffering, and they're dying. We have many options for Venezuela, including a possible military option, if necessary.
It was a mistake. When the mistakes of Trump's government are reckoned with, the declaration and military threat against Venezuela will be noted. It will stay with him all his life.
It's interesting to listen to the two of them. They're almost two sides of the same coin. You've got him on the left, and you've got Donald Trump on the right, and each of them is very good at going after his opponents.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, he says, look, I don't have any problem with Donald Trump. You know, he is what he is. The American system has finally succumbed to its worst elements, the lobbyists, the business interests, blah, blah, blah. But look, I'm a grown-up, and this is a big boy's game in a big world. You know, I'm willing to sit down and talk. There's no reason to go to war, blah, 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 blah. It was bluster, but it was canny bluster.
Let's go back just for a moment and talk about him as the almost as the anointed heir of Chavez, and certainly it's the way that he tries to cast himself.
From a personality and leadership standpoint, Hugo Chavez was, without any doubt, the strongest, most powerful, and greatest leader that Venezuela has had since the liberators. A humble and simple man, a man of the people, who, thanks to his military background, his military values and honor, knew how to embody, how to rediscover the ideals of Simón Bolívar.
Now, it has to be said, despite that overheated rhetoric, you know, Chávez was democratically elected. He repeatedly stood for elections, referendums. He changed the country's constitution according to majority votes and so on. Now, right towards the end, Chávez had been suffering from cancer in December of 2012. He did a live broadcast from Miraflores Palace in the same room where I interviewed Maduro and said, you know, my cancer's back. I'm going to have to go to Cuba for treatment. If anything should happen to me, I want Nicolas Maduro, who is seated to his left, to be my successor. And he disappeared. You know, he went to Cuba, and within the next few months, he died. He was never seen in public again. And there was, you know, Nicolas Maduro, his erstwhile foreign minister, very much a kind of a protege, never out front and center alongside this incredibly charismatic figure of Chavez. They had to hold the elections again, which he won with a wafer-thin majority.
So he came to power in 2013, pretty much almost immediately after Chavez died.
Literally within a month. So Maduro took power in 2013 with, you know, a real question mark hanging over his legitimacy. You know, Chavez had a huge and devoted following, almost feverish following. And Maduro was always a little bit, you know, he was definitely a deputy. And now suddenly he was trying to fill Chavez's shoes. He did so awkwardly at best in that period. And he was ridiculed for it. You know, he said at one point that Chavez had come to him in the form of a little bird. And then a year later, the oil prices, which had been at an all-time high in the world for, you know, the previous several years, bringing in $1 trillion to Venezuela, start to plummet. And they go from $120 to something like $30. You know, it just, the bottom fell out. And compounding matters, in December of 2015, they have legislative elections for their National Assembly, what we would call the Congress. And the opposition, for the first time in all of the years of Chavismo, in other words, since 1999, took a majority. Things reached a head early this year when the Supreme Court announced that it wanted to dissolve the National Assembly. The country erupted in protests and demonstrations, which lasted from March until the end of July. In the course of that time, Maduro began talking about a constituent assembly, which would replace the National Assembly. That both compounded the situation of volatility and polarization, caused even greater violence to erupt on the streets. Every day you had National Guardsmen battling it out with young protesters, some of them throwing Molotov cocktails, for the most part throwing rocks or yelling. They were shooting tear gas and live ammunition. There were deaths every day. And, Maduro insisted on this constituent assembly. The opposition said this was a hijacking of and an end to the democracy, that he was seeking dictatorial powers to get rid of the National Assembly and replace it with this parallel structure. And that effectively killed off the National Assembly and represented the end of any sort of checks and balances on Maduro's power.
John Lee, is this what a country looks like when a dictatorship forms, when essentially when democracy dies?
something like this, maybe. But it's not only Venezuela. We're seeing this around the world where, you know, we started calling them authoritarian democracies when we saw this trend by presidents in getting constitutional assemblies to perpetuate term limits or get rid of them. So you have a trend around the world towards authoritarianism. And in Venezuela, you had a very effective dictatorship in the 40s and 50s, that military dictatorship. All of the big public works projects were done then. And then you had 40 years of laissez-faire democracy and a lot of corruption preceding Chavez. There's not a deep-seated faith or time on the ground experience with effective democracy. There's not a notion, there's not a real understanding of democracy. So to ascribe what's taking place in Venezuela as an end to democracy and a beginning of dictatorship, I don't think quite defines it either. It's a mixture of democratic rhetoric and revolutionary intent and dictatorial DNA in a way.
They say there's a dictatorship in Venezuela, a strange dictatorship, where people have broad liberties, where the people go out to vote at least once a year, where the people choose their leaders freely with direct voting, secret voting, where there is an educational system that is open, diverse. Venezuela has a democratic society in revolution.
But he told you he's been really lenient toward the opposition.
That's right. No, and he says that they need to, in the future, they need to act with more firmness.
If in the United States, the political opposition movements to the government, to the system, were to launch a campaign like the one the Venezuelan opposition led against the Venezuelan Democratic Government this year, all would be sent to the electric chair. No one would be saved. Because nations have norms, rules, laws, and all nations have a right to defend themselves.
Right, so this is Maduro, the tough guy. He's saying, look, you know, we had to go through a lot of pain and violence this year, attempted coups, and the people, and you know, people who were burned, like they were burned by the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. You know, there was a Chavista kid who was burned to death in one of these things. He said, that's not going to happen again in Venezuela. And if the opposition tries to create these kinds of disturbances again, they're going to be hurt very badly, much worse than they were this time.
Well, and now he's faced with sanctions. How worried is he about that?
Well, they're worried about the sanctions. It's limiting their ability to maneuver. But not only did Maduro tell me that, you know, whatever the Americans do to us, there are still countries out there that want to do business with us and have friendly relations with us. And he named Russia, China, and India.
Fortunately, Venezuela has good relations with very powerful countries like China, Russia, India. And we have been able to grow investments in the oil field, in the energy field, with the most important energy industries in the world.
And an American official separately also said to me that, you know, and this is a paraphrasing of what he said. He said, you know, we don't have any tools in the tool chest anymore to deal with Venezuela because, you know, Russia appears to want to continue to bail them out, and China may too.
This is not the Venezuela of 99. It's not the Venezuela of 2002. The Venezuela of 2017 is a Venezuela that stands on its own two feet.
This has been a situation that's actually been in the making for, you know, the better part of the past 17 years, a little longer. And so now, in lieu of a decent and healthy American relationship, yes, you have Russia, you have China. The real question here is, what does the U.S. do about that? Because Venezuela was the model American democracy in the region for decades, because it has gone off the cliff. We're also allowing countries with whom we compete and in some cases have hostile relationships, namely Russia and China, to pick up the slack and to gain influence where we are rescinding our own. You have an increasingly hostile government there, and you have a hostile government here. Without a middleman playing any significant role that could bring the two parts together, I think it's worrisome. We don't need a Venezuela to become like Cuba was in 1961 or 62. We should be engaging with Venezuela because it is going through the sewer on our watch, and it's right here. So right now, it's a good opportunity to tackle this problem. We're still buying Venezuela's oil. In a sense, we're keeping it alive while hurling invective at it.
John Lee, you talked to him for a long time. Was there any point at which he was actually honest with you about what is really going on in Venezuela?
Well, I think right at the end of our talk, you know, I asked him, I said, do you want a one-party state like Cuba? Is that what you want? Is that what you want in this revolution? He said, no, I want a democratic country with an opposition, but an opposition that doesn't take its orders from Washington. He said, yeah, they all want me to leave, but who would sit in this chair? If I get up, who sits here? And, you know, he's got a point, actually.
You can find John Lee Anderson's reporting on Nicolas Maduro and the state of democracy in Venezuela, such as it is, at newyorkerradio.org. We also heard from Dorothy Wickenden of The New Yorker. We're going to wrap things up today with a trip to the library in the company of Christina Enriquez. She's best known for the novel The Book of Unknown Americans, and she's published a number of stories in The New Yorker. Enriquez was born in Delaware and spent summers growing up in Panama. But she came of age as a writer in Chicago, or strictly speaking, just a little west of the Chicago city line.
We are in front of the Hinsdale Public Library. It's a red brick building with sort of, I guess you would call this a portico, maybe. It's a very sort of picturesque little place. And usually there's a line of people waiting outside to get in the morning, and there's these steps that go up to the front door. And I walk in the front door, and it used to be that I would get a study room when I was here. So I would come to the information desk. They kind of know me now. So they would see me coming, and they would just not even have to ask and say, oh, you need a study room, which was sort of great. So you come in, and there's just a big open space. There is a shelf right in front of you with books that are on hold. Those are all the books that you can get through interlibrary loan, which is magical. And then there's a new fiction shelf over to your right. And then on your left, there's the checkout desk. Sometimes I came on Thursday, and I just watched people. There's a guy I know. I recognize him. He's always using the computer here. You know, there's another guy who comes in, and I know where he likes to sit, which is back in a corner in a particular spot. And I realized it because I tried to sit there one time, and then he came back and looked at me. And so I leave it alone now on purpose, even though it's a really great spot. I tried to write a story about him one time, but maybe he recognizes me the way I recognize him. There's the crazy lady who tried to steal my seat one time. That's what he might think.
All right, go get your books.
So if the study rooms are booked, this is where I go, into the quiet reading room.
Okay. Is that work?
And then I just sit in here. See, I can't talk. You can hear the trains from town, but that's about it. There was a girl in here the other day who I thought was violating the rules. She got on her phone. And I, at first, was sort of giving her angry looks, you know, like, what are you doing? And then all of a sudden she said, how long ago? And I sort of just instantly realized that somebody had died and she had just missed it. She maybe had been in a hospital room and had left and had missed it. And then she started crying. And then I was like feeling very bad about my angry look. So I got up and I came out of the room and got tissues off of the information desk, and I just went back in and put the tissues down next to her. So we'll go back down to the fiction, which is sort of my bread and butter, the place that makes me the most excited. I mean, I love this, because look, you look down here and I'm like, oh, here's this Alice Munro book that I also have on my shelf at home, and here's Nami Moon's book, and she's a Chicago author. So it feels, you know, like you're seeing friends when you walk down the shelves and the aisles and you see all the books. So I just like doing that. There's something nourishing. Oh, here's Maile Malloy, Liars and Saints. That's a good book. Sometimes I feel weirdly like the universe is speaking to me, like that I find the things that I was meant to find at that moment, that like I needed in my life and didn't realize I needed, especially in terms of writing. Well, let's find Juno Diaz. That's one of my favorites. So we have to find D. And we'll turn around. Let's see. D-I-E. Yeah. Juno Diaz, This Is How You Lose Her, which is a good one. My favorite Juno Diaz book is Drown, which is his first short story collection. I think part of the reason that I've loved certain authors is because they've given me permission to do something I didn't know I was allowed to do. Like, you can just write the way you would talk. G-R-I through H-O-L, I guess that means I'll be over here. Sometimes I'm next to Ernest Hemingway. Aha, The Book of Unknown Americans. There it is, in hardcover with the library dust jacket, which has that satisfying crinkle. For a long time when I lived here, the librarians were the only people who knew my name, or, you know, like they were the only friends that I had in this town. There was a librarian who used to work here named Michaela, who I just loved. And I remember after The Book of Unknown Americans was on a few lists, she said something about it. And then I was so nerdy because there was a list that she didn't say. She was like, oh, it was on the Washington Post, and it was a New York Times notable book of the year. And then she sort of stopped talking, and I jumped in. Like, I was a little boastful about it, and I was like, and it was an Amazon top 10 book of the year. I wanted to, like, impress her because, like, the librarians to me are the heroes. They're my heroes. Yeah, what would we do without them?
Your attention, please. The library will be closed in 15 minutes. If you need to call for a ride, please do so at this time. Thank you.
Christina Enriquez at the Public Library in Hinsdale, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. And that's it for today. Thanks for listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Please join us next week for some holiday surprises. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Avi Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Derek John, Johnny Vincevins, Terrence Bernardo, Ted Canyes, Stefania Taladrid, Camila Osorio, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.